You're listening to Sound Poetry. I am your host, David Gilmore. This is Radio Tacoma, KTAH 101.9, and you're listening to Sound Poetry. We're very pleased today to have with us a man with a very poetic name, Michael Dylan Welch, which should ring poetically for the Welch in the audience. But Michael, tell us, would you please, because your biography is so complete about your connections in haiku poetry with many groups, the North American group and local groups, tell us a little about your influence there and how long you've been involved with the haiku societies, would you?
Yes, first, thank you very much for having me. I'm glad to join you today. My background in poetry is, I think, where I might start. I'm named after Dylan Thomas, which I think gave me a poetic awareness that my siblings didn't have. I remember writing poetry as a child, and I remember my mother gently correcting me if my rhymes weren't quite right or if my scansion wasn't perfect. And it was supportive. And I remember even next door neighbor, when I was like 8 years old or 10 years old, would encourage me my poetry. I was an English major. I have a master's in English, writing poetry through all that time, and starting to publish in various poetry journals in my college years. And then right during grad school, I became involved with the Haiku Society of America. I had encountered haiku in books about Zen or Taoism, and that was a small interest of mine, and I kept encountering haiku that way. And I remember first being taught haiku incorrectly when I was in high school. So I started writing haiku in 1976, and I've been writing them ever since, and really badly for at least 12 years. All I knew was to count syllables, and I did that very carefully and also put titles on all my haiku. And not only are the titles never used in Japan, the syllables that we think haiku should have, it's not really accurate, because in Japan, they don't count syllables, they count sounds that are different from syllables. For example, the word haiku itself is three sounds in Japanese, but two syllables in English. So if you write 17 syllables in English, you're actually writing a much longer poem than they are in Japan. And I recently read something that said, if you write 17 syllables in English, that is almost enough words for two haiku in Japanese. That's how radically much longer 17 syllables can be in weight compared to the Japanese haiku. And another metaphor for that is, if you think of haiku in Japan as being a baseball, that particular size, in 17 sounds, in English, if you write 17 syllables, you're actually producing a softball in size. And it's just a different weight, a different size, different density. It's just not the same. So anyway, I got involved with the Haiku Society of America in 1988, I think it was, maybe 87, and began to be involved with various haiku organizations and also writing a lot of longer poetry, and have also served in a leading capacity with various organizations as well.
You're a practitioner, almost a daily practitioner. In fact, you even mentioned perhaps several might be composed in a day or begun in a day. Is that right? You write almost every day, do you?
Almost every day. Not necessarily haiku. I write longer poetry. I'm currently on a practice of writing at least one longer poetry every day, plus a haiku occasionally. And it averages out about to one or so a day over the year.
As a poet and as an essay writer too, you have a quite elaborate website, which I will give out, www.graceguts.com, which is an omnibus on particular publications and organizations that you belong to. So listeners can go to that website, greatguts.com, and find out a great deal more than you'll probably have chance to hear in the half an hour. How about reading a haiku for us to get us going? Maybe one of your hardball ones instead of the softball type.
This is a favorite one. Meteor shower. A gentle wave wets our sandals. What I'm aiming at in a poem like that is, first of all, a concrete image, something that's everyday and experienceable, relatable, not too esoteric. We've all seen a meteor shower, or I hope so. So that immediately gives us perhaps a summer feeling. And that's one of the targets that haiku aims at, is to have some sort of seasonal reference. And then there's a shift. So we have the setting of meteor shower, and then there's a shift to a gentle wave wets our sandals, which to me is very tactile, and also a shift from looking up to looking down. And what I like to imagine is that I've been there absorbed by watching the meteor shower for so long that I failed to notice that the tide has changed. And here comes some waves that are gently wetting our sandals. And I also like the circularity of it, in that, you know, the moon causes our tides, and it's a celestial object, and here I am watching celestial objects, and one of those celestial objects is directly affecting even the tide that's lapping at my feet. So that's the kind of tactile image I'm trying to convey with that particular poem.
That isn't the title, though. That is the first line of a three-line haiku, right?
That's the first line is meteor shower, yes.
Yes, so there's no title. You don't give titles to yours, then. You said that
haiku should not have titles.
No, the Japanese don't give them, but many English writers of haiku do seem to add a title phrase. I don't know why, too. Why do you think that started?
I think that's just incorrect. Anybody who uses titles clearly hasn't been reading the literature and seeing translations. And now a sequence might use a title, but that's something else. So what's happening, I think, if anybody is using a title, they're just applying Western poetics to what they think of a haiku is, and not even understanding why haiku do not have titles in Japanese, which is generally because the title just overwhelms the poem. It's so short, and usually a title, most poetry is used to direct attention, or it's a misdirection, or it's a summation of the poem, all of which are antithetical to the aesthetics of how haiku works. So no title, just the image. You have two parts that are juxtaposed with each other. Meteor shower, one thing. Gentle wave wets our sandals, second thing. The two things have a relationship. It's sort of like mixing baking soda and vinegar, and they go whoosh. And there's a chemical reaction that is meant to go on in the relationship of the two parts, and it makes having titles just superfluous.
Right. Yes, I think in some cases, English teachers who get their young students to start writing haiku don't inform them fully about some of the technical aspects. Maybe they don't even tell them about the seasonal aspect or even the surprise that might be there in the third line or a line. Sometimes the children love writing them, but they never quite catch on until perhaps later on in life. When you started, you said you were very young, 8 years old or so, when you said you began, right?
Began writing poetry, yes.
And did you get it right at first?
When I was a teenager.
Did you get it right at first?
All I thought was I had to count syllables and put a title on it, both of which are incorrect. So no, nope. I did not get it right for 12 years.
Did you have a mentor who actually noticed that you needed to be straightened out a bit on this?
No. I'd read some haiku in translation over the years, and I remember getting a translation of Basho from Japan in England in 1987 or so. And later that year, I remember I was in California, I got a copy of Cor Vandenhoevel's The Haiku Anthology, the second edition, which was published in 1987, I believe, or 86. And the vast bulk of the poems in that anthology were not 575. And that puzzled me, because I thought, like everyone I was taught, haiku is 575. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how misguided teachers are and curriculums are in our schools. But that's what we were all taught. And so when I encountered this book, I was puzzled. And it did address the issue, but it didn't really sink in until I started trying it myself a little bit more. And I began, a huge thing happened when I encountered that book. Before then, my focus was on form. And that's true for many people. It's a standard common thing. But when I encountered that book and realized that there are differences in language that make 575 too long compared to Japanese, the big shift for me was to think about content instead of form. And I started thinking about other targets that are more important than form, of which 575 is just one choice and I think a misguided one. There are many other approaches to form in haiku that one can make. But by thinking about content, I was also thinking about other targets like the season word called the kigo and that two-part structure, which in Japanese is created by using what's called the kireji or cutting word. Kire means cut, and the poem is cut in two in a traditional haiku in Japanese. And it's the relationship of those two parts, the juxtaposition, that creates the energy and the space in the poem that gives an emotional space for the reader. You don't know what one part has to do with the second part necessarily. It's not necessarily obvious. But if you think about it, you dwell in the moment, you hopefully will get a feeling. And that's the point of the haiku, is to get a feeling.
Yes. Well, would you give us an example of a short two-part haiku that shows the cut and the final phrase to exemplify what you've just spoken about?
Yeah, so the meteor shower is an example. It's one thing. And then another thing is the gentle way of wetting our saddles. So that's immediate example.
Do another one. Give us another example of perhaps one of yours, and that will also add to what you have just said.
Here's one of mine. First snow. The children's hangers clatter in the closet. First snow tells us the season. And I end that line with an ellipsis. That's the break. And then the second part, the shift in the poem, is the children's hangers clatter in the closet. So it's just that image. Something else that's really important that I haven't mentioned is the words are objective. It's primarily objective sensory imagery. So it dwells in the five senses, and there's no judgment. There's no saying how beautiful the sunset is. No, don't say that. Say red and orange clouds at the horizon and let us imagine that it's beautiful. Be descriptive for the most part. Be objective. And I find when teaching haiku that it's surprising how many people are not aware which words they use are objective versus subjective. That's probably the hardest thing to get a handle on for Westerners who are trying to learn haiku in a traditional Japanese manner. And in Japan, haiku poets will write with what's called a saijiki, which is a season word almanac. And you can get little pocket editions or electronic versions or cell phone apps that do this. But more elaborate ones are literally the size of encyclopedias, very huge reference books, multiple volumes and so on. And a saijiki will categorize a lot of terms by season and which part of the season, or like early, mid, or late spring, or all spring, and give an example haiku and give you some explanation of the botany or whatever else is relevant with that season word. And so if you're writing a season word, sometimes you need to check your saijiki unless you've learned where things belong. And a case in point, and it's actually problematic in Japan somewhat, even here, as well as here. For example, the word moon happens year-round, but it's assigned to the autumn season. So if you have a moon verse, in Japan, everybody understands, if they write haiku, they understand that you mean in autumn. And if you mean the moon in some other season, you need to say that, like spring moon. If you don't modify it, then it's understood to be an autumn moon, unless there's something else in the poem that conveys the season. Yeah, there things are assigned to season word seasons, and it's that seasonal reference, that seasonal context, that actually matters more than the nature context. And I was going to say about the Saijiki, all the entries that are listed, typically about 75% of them are nature related, but a quarter of them are not. And sometimes that's forgotten in the way of understanding haiku. It's not just a nature poem. But of course, nature is a wonderful inspiration a lot of the time too.
Sure. Yes. Even in, to enlarge on even the idea of season, since you mentioned a meteor shower, and then later on the snow one, which of course is, that is a climatic condition. There's a cosmic element involved, especially with the iconography of the moon and the metaphors that go along with that, as well as the sun and so forth, and metaphors that go along with that. So you've got the, often the heavens, and you, as in your the water lapping and wetting the sandals, you come down to the bottom of your feet. So you're, you know, head high, way beyond your head high, down to your wetting feet. Yes, it's very, very interesting how the cosmic
and sometimes
dimensions are so great. Yeah.
They can be, and it's also can be a near and far rather than up and down. It could also be external and internal. There are variations of how you can shift the poem. So here's another poem of mine. Spring breeze, the pull of her hand as we near the pet store. So in this case, I've named the season rather than picking something that's typical of a season. And what arrested me in this experience was the pull of, it happened to be my girlfriend at the time, and it was a coffee shop. But normally I walk faster than her, but here she was pulling my hand, wanted to go faster than me.
Yes.
Because it was kind of cool and she wanted to go inside to this coffee shop. And I loved the enthusiasm, the eagerness in that pull. So that's where the haiku began for me, is in this case, a tactile sensory image of the pull of her hand. And that felt spring-like. It felt like the energy of spring. So I immediately put it in spring instead of the summer when it happened.
Yeah. So yes, you mentioned that one. There's very, very little of what you call nature, but greater nature in the tactile feel of another being who's creating a force, pulling you along towards a desired location. Yeah. That's a great example of where nature is only subtly hinted at, and of a type, the human nature, the emotions of the human being. Very good. And the breeze is also gives you a feeling of perhaps some of the speed of that being pulled along, ushered along quickly. Read us another one. I'd love you to spend a few minutes reading some so that listeners can get a full experience of them.
Okay, here's another one. Crackling beach fire. We hum in place of words we can't recall. It's meant to suggest summer. And when I say we hum in place of words we can't recall, I'm implying that we must be singing around the campfire, perhaps with a guitar or something.
Right. There's a certain noisiness to that, with the crackling and the humming and the activity that goes on around a campfire. Very musical. What you might call a resonant with all sorts of sounds.
I hope so. Yes. Yeah. And I also, a haiku will so often leave things out. And David Mamet, who's written a lot of plays and and so on, has said that in scene writing, you arrive late and leave early in the scenes. Because when you arrive late, you can imply what happened. And if you leave early, you can imply what is going to happen. And haiku does that all the time. So crackling beach fire. I haven't told you it's night. I haven't told you the season, but hopefully you can add that. And then the humming of the words, well, why? I've left that out. And then I also imply that, you know, you're going to be there for a while afterwards as well. So I like this idea of pointing before and after the moment that the poem focuses on.
Yes. Another one, please.
Okay. After the quake, the weather vane pointing to Earth. This was inspired by the 1989 Loma Prieta earthquake in California, in the San Francisco area, where I was living at the time in 1989. And it was pretty traumatic. I couldn't stay in my house because of the fear of a gas leak. And there were a lot of problems. Many dozens of people died. There were a lot of things that fell down. Building I was in when the earthquake happened, many of the windows popped out. All the ceiling tiles fell down among us. Filing cabinets and computers fell down on the floor. It was pretty scary. And the aftermath, long after the news, for months, you'd have vertigo, the slightest aftershock, or the taps would run brown, or there were just endless problems. But one of the things I remember seeing was a weather vane that had been knocked crooked, pointing to Earth. And one thing I like about this is it's almost like the weather vane is pointing out the culprit of the quake. The quake was caused by the Earth shifting, and the weather vane is pointing that to sort of tell us who's at fault. Obviously, weather vane can't operate correctly anymore, so we have that bit of empathy with it as well. But in this case, there's not really a seasonal reference, and there's not really a two-part structure either. There's a slight pause after the first line, after the quake, and then the rest of it is one unit, the weather vane pointing to Earth, even though it's spread into two lines. But the pause is very subtle, and there's no seasonal reference here.
Yes, but the mention of weather, though it doesn't imply a season, is vain, which of course can be taken as the weather is empty, it's vain. But this is an arrow, perhaps, you have in mind pointing, right, in the weather vane.
It could be some sort of arrow.
But sometimes roosters are very common as the sort of flat plate image of a weather vane, right? So its beak could be pointing down too. And of course, that also brings to mind the cock crow, which is often an alarm at the beginning of day. And this one, the alarm has gone off beforehand.
Yes.
Yeah, it's got a lot. I think it's resonant of many, many images, that one, and thoughts.
Ultimately, I think haiku is a poetry of empathy. I remember reading another book that I got very early on when I was finally studying haiku and not doing them very badly. Was I got William Higginson's The Haiku Handbook, which I still recommend is the best introductory book about haiku, even though it was published in 1986. The very first paragraph of that book says that the purpose of haiku is to share them. And in that act of sharing, you become vulnerable because you sort of say, hey, this matters to me. And it asks the question, does it matter to you? And in that act of vulnerability, I think a bond is possible. The reader can connect to the poet through the poetry. And that act of sharing is sort of a validation of experience for the writer and the reader. If I see a haiku by someone else and I relate to it, I'm validating their experience and also validating my own. And we share a moment of vulnerability, I think, in that process. And empathy comes into that as well. But it's through this act of sharing that this is all possible. And I think it's more true for haiku than for longer poetry because they are so personal, so experiential.
How many people usually attend around a table to read haiku when you go to a meeting? You go to several meetings, I noticed in your bio. How many sit around and have a chance to perform one of their haiku?
So I first got involved with the haiku poets in Northern California when I lived in the San Francisco area. And in those early years, it was typically 40, 50 people.
Wow.
And it took a while to get around for everyone just to read one poem. And usually there was somebody giving some sort of presentation. And those numbers have dwindled, I think, but still 30 or 40 people at most of those that group's meetings. Locally here in the Seattle area with the Haiku Northwest group that I participate in, I remember the meetings used to be 30 people fairly regularly. They've gradually gone down a number. And I think that's because a lot of members have, some have died, some have moved away, got a few new members occasionally. And of course, with the pandemic, we're not meeting in person, which actually makes it easier for some people to attend via Zoom. I would say in the last few years, for the Haiku Northwest group, the meetings have been roughly 10 to 15 people, occasionally smaller than that.
Right. Yes. It's not so sad when a poetry group diminishes sometimes, because then others have a chance to be more leisurely in their reading. Maybe there's a little more quietness around the reading instead of the hastening to the next one because you've got 50 people to get around. Do you know any sad haikus? Unhappy? Elegiac, elegiac perhaps.
I've collected poems that I've written for poets who have died. There's sadness in some of them. Haiku, you know, if it's a seasonal reference and it's about a personal experience, it can seem positive a lot of the time, but it doesn't have to be. It can be very sad. It can be very negative. It can be critical. Sad poems. This was written for John Wills, who was a well-known haiku poet. Scattered ashes. How still each reed and its shadow. He had a book called Reed Shadows, which is what I'm alluding to here. But I'm imagining his ashes being scattered among reeds at the edge of a pond. So scattered ashes, how still each reed and its shadow. Here's another one. This is for a Japanese-American writer who she lived in Arizona, I think. Her name is Keiko Imaoka. A wrenching in my chest, the white peony pulled from the garden. So you can imagine that I'm pulling a peony from the garden, and that act of pulling it wrenches my chest. That's one way to look at it. Or you can look at it metaphorically, is that for some reason a white peony has been pulled from the garden, and it hurts my heart. And that's really what it was, because this poem was written after Keiko Imaoka committed suicide. A wrenching in my chest, the white peony pulled from the garden. So in this sense, it's symbolic. And yet I hope it also operates on a non-symbolic level as well. So here's another poem. This is written for Kyoko Tokutomi, who is co-founder of the Yukiteke Haiku Society in California. In a long time ago, 70s maybe. And she passed away in 2002. And this is a poem written for her. It refers to a Silomar, which is a conference center near Monterey, where the society has had an annual retreat for dozens of years. I went for 12 years myself. It's been going for 30, I think. So the poem is Asilomar Dunes. She rests her hand against the tree she planted. So the setting, Asilomar Dunes, it's a nod to this event that she was a key person in running. And she rests her hand, could be a sign of growing older, against the tree she planted. And I mean that literally, a tree she planted, but I also mean it metaphorically, in that she planted a tree of the haiku organization that she started with her husband. And now this tree is older and is old enough for her to rest her hand against it. And so it's a nod to what she's accomplished. And the resting of her hand is also a gesture of compassion, of love, of appreciation for those that she has nurtured. So in this case, it's not sad. Hopefully it's much more celebratory. Here's another. I can read another one?
Yes, you may.
So this one was written about the Iraq War. This was written in August of 2003. Iraqi sunset. A sand dune begins to build around his boot print. So I hope you can imagine, this is a projection poem, even if you've never been there. An Iraqi sunset. You can imagine someone's boot print starting to collect, the wind is beginning to collect sand, and you could imagine, it's like the butterfly effect, you know, the smallest thing makes a big change. And here you might imagine the blueprint beginning to form something as big as a sand dune.
Right.
This was written for Navy Lieutenant Kylan Jones Huffman, who was killed in the Iraq War. He was a haiku poet. The last poem he's known to have written was this: Uncomfortable. Body armor shifting on the car seat.
That as a memorial idea is very interesting, stark, and brutal too.
Here's a poem about poetry. I run a lot of poetry readings, and this was inspired by one of them. Another winter poem. Warm winter evening. The chairs askew. After the poetry reading. So that moment of, you know, the reading has ended and people are chatting and being friendly, that time of unstructured socialization, I think, is implied here. And to me, it's part of what makes the winter evening warm. And here's one more. This was inspired by my wife. Valentine's Day. She reminds me to fasten my seatbelt. Valentine's Day. She reminds me to fasten my seatbelt, which to me is an act of love and care and caring and compassion and connection.
The empathetic element there, very high.
Yes.
Thank you very much for the afternoon, Michael. Wonderful poems. Wonderful.
You've been listening to the haiku verse of Michael Dylan Welch, who lives in Sammamish, and his website, graceguts.com. Please visit it. You won't be disappointed. Thanks a lot, Michael.
Thank you very much.